Did you apply to be an astronaut?
What?
You didn't know there's open applications to be an astronaut right now.
I don't want to be an astronaut. I like being on Earth.
I thought with all your Kerbal Space Program experience, you'd be a good candidate.
I mean, my Kerbals die, like, a lot.
Okay, so maybe not then. I went through, for some reason, I got it in my head. Like, I just kept going one level deep, and then one level deeper, I got to, like, the actual job description, which I thought was kind of funny because it had a, there's a bullet point for it for requiring frequent travel, which is kind of amusing to me. And then I just kept going, and I was like, well, what does it take to actually apply? And then I was like, oh, I got to register for this account. So I registered for the account, and then I was like, okay, oh, I have to create a resume? Well, I guess I could just copy and paste what I have on LinkedIn. So I went through that process, and then that was kind of a pain in the butt, and then, like, at like the second job description, I was like, why am I like, they're not going to make me an astronaut. What am I doing? But I kept going. And then it was like, you need a transcript. You need to submit your college transcript. So what did I do? I went off to my college website, paid them $2.50 to get my actual transcript. And I was like, well, I guess I'm doing this now. I guess I'm applying to be an astronaut.
So are you going to space? Have you heard back?
I haven't heard back. The applications don't close until February, but,
did it give you like a, we'll get back to you shortly message.
Yeah. That kind of thing. Maybe they'll send me an actual letter. That'd be nice. On NASA letterhead that says, ha-ha, no thanks. That's what I'm thinking.
I don't know. I mean, like, presumably they train their astronauts. So other than the NASA astronaut training, which you can only really get if you're training to be an astronaut, like, what would it take?
I think you'd probably have to be a lot smarter than I am. You probably would have had to do a lot better in school than I did.
What were the prereqs on that? Did they list any?
There are some prerequisites, like for, you have to have a very specific, not a very specific college degree, but you have to have like a science, like computer science is one of the degrees that you could have. So I fulfilled that. And then it was like at least 3 years of progressively responsible jobs or 1,000 hours of flight time, which clearly I don't have 1,000 hours of flight time. But I wonder if hot air balloon flight counts.
Of course. Why wouldn't it?
So, you know, maybe we could combine our powers and being an ideal candidate. So about a week or two ago, as we're recording this, I shipped Scenic version 1.0.0, which is pretty exciting. It's the first time I shipped like version one of a library that is actually my own code and not a wrapper around something that I anticipate a number of people actually using and that I'm getting a good deal of use out of. I've maintained other people's code for a long time. So it was pretty exciting and interesting to decide like, yeah, let's go ahead and call this 1.0.
So what does 1.0 mean for you? For Scenic.
For Scenic, what it means is we're using this in production and I'm committed to this. Like, I feel good enough about this API to say, I think you could use it too. Right. And I am not going to needlessly break backward compatibility. Like, from this point on, if I'm going to break backward compatibility, I have to have a good enough reason to tell you that you need to make changes in your app to accommodate that.
Right.
And I think, you know, we actually got into a discussion about semantic versioning offline a couple weeks ago surrounding that, like, there's a lot of talk about people saying, who cares? Like, NPM, somebody mentioned that NPM, when you start a new library with NPM, it starts you off at version 1.0, right? You get no pre-release. And there was some back and forth about how, like, I would think that's pretty presumptuous, right? That you're going to get, you're going to nail your 1.0 release the minute you push to GitHub or NPM.
Right.
And other people saying, well, who cares? You're going to continually make changes. As long as you keep bumping that major version when you make breaking changes, what does it matter? And I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle, as usual. Like, you can't just keep bumping the major version because nobody wants to use a library that they just have to constantly chase breaking changes on.
Right. That is what the 0.0 is for, saying like, hey, this is a thing and you can use it. I mean, if it's not usable or if it's dangerous, like, you probably shouldn't be pushing it to public package repositories in the first place. But if it's up there and it's 0.0, I mean, that is, in my mind, saying, hey, this is there and usable and, like, it might be useful to you, but, yeah, you're going to be chasing breaking changes, and if you're okay with that, then cool.
Right, and I'm ready to go, like, you know, I'm at 0.1 today, and it might be, or I'm at 0.1 today, and it might be 0.2 tomorrow, and it might be an entirely different API. Like, I make no guarantees at all. I'm not going to needlessly break things, but I'm also, like, assuming that people who are using this are, they've taken the signal. but I don't know if that's something you can actually rely on in Ruby, right? Because we've talked about this before. Right. There's a lot of gems that are 0 point. Like, if you open your gem file right now, there's a lot of very well-established gems that are sitting at 0 point whatever.
Yeah, MySQL 2 gem, which is what everybody using MySQL with Rails is using, is 0.4.2 right now.
Right. So technically they're not. I think that's a mixture of either people just don't know that, like, people are trying to follow semantic versioning and they miss the 2 points in semantic versioning that talk very specifically about everything being pre 1.0 does not define your public API, or they're just hesitant to call a 1.0 because then they're committed.
Right. I mean, I think it's more of the latter, which
they're hesitant.
They're afraid that they don't want to commit to not making breaking changes. Which, I mean, you're not committing to not make breaking changes. You're just committing to bumping your major version if you want to make breaking changes.
Right, and hopefully considering the impact that's going to have on users. You know, at this point, I'm looking at the Scenic repo right now. We haven't actually announced it anywhere other than talking about it a little bit on this podcast and a couple of tweets, but I haven't done the blog post yet. I'm going to put that out soon when I get some time to write it. Start talking about why you might want to use something like this. It's got 156 stars. It has, what do we got for contributors? 7 contributors, we've done 5 releases. There's 83. There's not a lot of commits. There's not a lot of activity. So, like, right now, if I still came across something that I was like, oh, we should go right to 2.0, forget it. It wouldn't be a huge impact for people. So I think you have to kind of consider that as well. Like, how many people, and you don't have good numbers on how many people are using your gem. You have how many downloads you get on Ruby gems and how much activity you have on GitHub. But that's going to have to suffice, I guess.
Yeah. Do we have this on Ruby gems, like where it shows you downloads by day, or is it just total downloads of all time?
I think if you log into Ruby gems, it shows you a histogram.
Okay, because I mean, like, that gives you also decent, if you filter down to, like, how many downloads do you get in a given week, that's a decent indicator of usage as well. But, of course, it always also just depends on, like, how many times do new developers set up their machines for an existing app or stuff like that.
Right. If they did give you a histogram, they no longer do. I don't know when the redesign happened, if that fell out or if I'm just misremembering that being there.
But to your point about the that you don't think going to 2.0 right now would have that big of an impact because you don't think you have that many users, like, that does all come into a bigger formula, I guess, right, of breaking changes cost your users. That is, in my opinion, an undeniable fact. If you make a breaking change, it's going to have an impact on your users. And not making that breaking change, generally speaking, if you want to make it, then not making that change has some cost on you. If it's maintenance burden or an API you're unhappy with or what have you, really the only time you should make a breaking change is when the cost to you so significantly outweighs the cost to your users that it's just like, how can you not make this? Or if the cost to you is, if it's like a confusing API and the cost to your users is absurdly huge there as well, right? And so part of what quantifies the cost to your users is also a function of how many users you have. If you have 3 users, then... well, you could probably actually go on Twitter and say, hey, you 3, you cool with this change? Awesome, I'm making it, which is what I did before I released 0.1 of Diesel when I had like 2 or 3 users. I'd ask them, I'd get feedback on every breaking change, right? But it's very unlikely, in my opinion, once you have an established user base of any size, that the maintenance burden on you of not making some breaking change actually outweighs the cost to your users. I'm not saying it never happens. It certainly happens sometimes, but right, very rarely.
And there's a couple, so I have a couple points I wanted to make about that. One is an agreement with you in that, like, a lot of people will say, like, well, they can continue to use version 1.0. I'm moving on to version 2.0, which is okay. And I feel like that's an okay argument depending on the type of library you have, right? If you're making a Rails plugin of some sort, you're only going to support the newer versions of Rails on your newer versions of your library. You're not going to go back and add, you're unlikely to go back and add Rails 5 support to your 0.x series or your 1.x series when you're on 5.x, right?
Right.
So that those kinds of things do force users to have to, like, confront these deprecations at some point. And it's particularly bad if they've been, like, if they've given up on following along with you because you're just making too many breaking changes, then having to all of a sudden jump forward 4 major versions or 5 major versions or whatever the case may be, because they just have to upgrade Rails now, is particularly onerous. It's tough. Well,
and ironically, if Rails followed Semver, that wouldn't be a problem.
Why is that?
Well, if let me rephrase. If Rails followed Semver and wasn't so gung-ho with breaking changes, so that the major version rarely, if ever, got bumped,
right,
then it wouldn't matter. Like a gem that's compatible with latest released major, which if we're following Semver, as long as the major doesn't change, you continue to be compatible.
Right. And it probably wouldn't, it also wouldn't be, if you combined like strictly following Semver with smaller releases, I feel like it's a little bit easier to get a handle on. Like, oh, okay, fixing this security issue ended up, like the best way to fix the security issue ended up being bumping the major version.
Right.
Right. That's fine. I take that one update. Cool. We move on. And then if like the next release is 6 weeks later and it's got three or four different changes in it, a couple of them are breaking, like rather than a year and a half worth of breaking changes piling up and you being like, okay, I have to see how this impacts my app. I wonder what my test, like your first step is like, I'm going to run my test, see what deprecations I get, see what breaks. You know, it's just not, it's a less smooth experience. But then I also talk to people who are in writing Ember apps right now who feel tremendously pressured to keep up with deprecations in their app that they're seeing when from these frequent releases. So it kind of cuts both ways. It's interesting.
Well, and that's the argument too, is that you shouldn't be making breaking changes all the time and bumping your major all the time. You should be deprecating things if you're gonna make a breaking change, and then yeah, once every year or so bump your major version and do all the garbage collection of your deprecations. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to, but that doesn't make it any easier in the long run, right? You're still making a breaking change. You're just making life a little bit easier for people following along who don't necessarily want to fix every deprecation right the second. Yeah, I mean, it really just comes down to it. Stop making so many breaking changes.
Well, I feel like in the early days of something trying to be as ambitious as like Ember, right? They have to just continually, like, there were a lot of people who say, I'm not going to use this until it's 1.0, right? Until it's deemed production ready. So you got to get to a 1.0. But if things are changing fast on your foot, then you have to be able to react to that, or you're just going to lose users, right? And if you want people to use your library, you think you have the best ideas, the best foundation, you want to be able to react quickly to whatever. React quickly to react. See what I did there? And being able to do that, like I feel like there's still a distinction between, there's probably still a distinction between a library that is 1.0 and a library that is stable. Is that fair?
Sure, but that's not the purpose of a version number. Like, put in your README, hey, we're moving fast and breaking things. Or just, in the case of something like Ember, right, it becomes incredibly obvious from the culture very early on. Like, this is a library that doesn't care as much about stability and wants to move fast, and you're going to be chasing them.
Right.
But that's not necessarily the purpose of the version number, right? The version number is just there to say, is code written against version X compatible with version Y?
Right. So I think like if I got into a little bit more specifics about Scenic, I actually have a couple of things that I think would be applicable to the discussion. It'd be interesting to see how, because I have ideas on how I want to handle them, but I'm not sold on them either. So like just an overview, we talked briefly about Scenic before, but basically it came out of Caleb Thompson and I worked on the T1D project that we talk about often. And one of the things it had was like full text search across different models. And the way we, and it used Postgres for that, not like Elasticsearch or something like that. And the way we accomplished that was, we'll link to a blog post in the show notes, but we essentially created a view of all the things that we wanted to search and then indexed the tables that underlied those view, underlaid. We indexed
something like that.
We indexed the tables that were under those views with full text, you know, indexes. Forget exactly what they're called. And then we were able to search against that. We wrote an active model against that view that searches that view. And that worked pretty well. We had to switch our schema format to SQL because Rails schema dumper doesn't support views out of the box. At the time, there was like Schema Plus, which did support like a create view statement in your migrations, but it also had a bunch of other stuff that was rolled up in it. They've since broken those out. So we considered using that, but even still, it didn't support versioning those views. So like if you wrote the first version of your search view and then you'd added a new type of thing that you wanted to search to the view and you wanted to rev your view, there was no easy way to say like, oh, create a new version of this view, keep the old schema around in case I want to roll back to it, but here's the new version, right? So what we ended up having to do was like we'd created a migration, in the up migration do the execute that defined our SQL, that defined our view, and then in the down migration do an execute that copied the previous schema and made the, you know, reverted the view back to what it was. So that was the very simple idea of what that came from, was like, what if we had some generators that created versioned SQL files, kind of like migrations that say like searches v1, searches v2.sql. And then your create view statement, you said create view, and it went off and it looked for version 1. And then you could say like create view v2, and it looked for version 2. And like create view was automatically reversible by the schema command recorder or whatever they call it. So all of that stuff is stuff you get with Scenic. That's basically what we built. So it integrates with the schema dumper, so you don't have to switch to your format to SQL. It has generators, so you can generate SQL view definitions that stand apart from your actual migrations. So in your migrations, you say create view searches, drop view searches, and then update view searches, and you give it the version you want to update to. And it knows to look in /db/views, and then it looks for the view name, _version, whatever. The README describes this better than I could, so we'll link to that in the show notes. So that was the basic idea of it. Did I explain that well enough?
Yeah.
Okay. So we very quickly, like, we kind of drew a line, like, we wanted the generators to work, and then the last thing we wanted to do was support materialized views. So we had support for materialized views, and then, like, what I did at that point, having learned my lesson from clearance, was I went through the whole code base and documented everything that I thought was public and explicitly marked things as private that I knew were private. Like you, we decided to ship with Postgres support only out of the box. And that, I felt like there was already one PR about MySQL support. We've gotten a couple like questions about MySQL support. And both Caleb and I have had experience maintaining gems that have adapters that we don't use. And it's not fun, right? Those adapters tend, like Caleb did it with Gridler. I did it a little bit with Clearance. Clearance not really an adapter, but it has password strategies that just went stale and were broken and nobody told me, and they were unused and until somebody opened an issue. And Caleb had adapters for Gridler, which is like a thing that interfaces with various mail services like Mailgun and SendGrid and all those. And if we aren't using them, it's hard for us to know when there are problems, and then it really stinks that we're responsible for fixing those problems. Right. So our decision, at least at 1.0, is to kind of like document the API that we expect adapters to adhere to, and then tell people if they want to create Scenic MySQL that depends on Scenic and sets the adapter, that's fine. Like, there's public API to change the adapter and all that stuff. So that was one thing we've kind of sidestepped, is the need. Like, we support adapters, but we don't write them ourselves. It turns out the adapters are pretty simple. So I may, like, if somebody writes a MySQL adapter and they support it well and it gets usage, like, and they're okay with pulling it back into the tree, then maybe we'll do that. But it remains to be seen. So once we announced 1.0, and like, I tweeted it out, I think you tweeted it out, but we never did like an announcement, but I definitely saw an uptick in usage just based on the issues I was seeing in a couple pull requests I saw. So it seems like people do wait to see if, like, are you going to do, like, ooh, at least 1.0 is at least marketing, right? That says, like, oh, I should take a look at this thing again. So people did take a look at it, and we got some pretty interesting problems right off the bat. So one is that we didn't consider views that depend on other views. So if you have, you know, having trouble coming up with this example, but basically, if you have one view that selects from another view inside of it, we just dump the views in alphabetical order. We don't consider the actual dependencies of the view. So I was like, okay, well, we won't do that. We'll just dump the views in insertion order, right? We can ask Postgres to give it to us in the order that they were created. That doesn't work, though, because you could if you had view B that depends on view A, right, you probably would have done create view A, create view B, but then you might have at some point dropped the original view and then recreated it. So I was thinking, okay, maybe that's not actually going to work. I'm gonna have to think through this one now. Like, we're gonna have to think through like a depends on syntax that we're gonna have to tell.
That, or if it's based on insertion order, but you maintain it separately so that dropping and recreating the view doesn't modify the insertion order. Like, if in your DSL you're maintaining some sort of metadata table where you're inserting it there, that could work as well, right?
Right. We decided not to do that. We wanted the entire, like, with version 1.0, we were like, we think we can do this without keeping like a Scenic metadata table. So we do this entirely on the file system.
Oh, okay.
So that might be one of the solutions. The other solution is like Postgres actually has data on what each object in your system depends on. And in fact, I ran into another issue, which is kind of related to this one, just yesterday when I created. So I have a table that had like, say, five columns on it. And one of them was a counter column that was a counter cache column. Then I created a view of that data that kind of obsoleted the counter cache. And so I was like, okay, after I created that view, I was like, oh, I no longer need the counter cache. So then I created another migration that said drop column that counter cache. And Postgres complained because it knew that my view was written with select star. And so my view depended on that column. So it would not let me drop that column until I dropped the view first, dropped the column, and then recreated the view. So already I'm starting to see some like usages. Like I had used this a lot, but then all of a sudden I just start like figures. Like once I was like, yeah, this is 1.0, I started to see some things that I was like, oh, actually, maybe we do need to maintain some semblance of schema somewhere.
Right.
And maybe we need big, like maybe we just live with Postgres telling you that you can't drop this column because it's used in a view, and then you have to go figure out what you have to go and edit the view yourself. Or is it something that like we catch that and then drop the view for you and recreate? It's like, oh,
that seems a little too magic.
Right.
I don't know. Like that's... I have similar issues with star in Diesel. One of the biggest ones being that for performance reasons, I always go off of columns by order, not by column name. And that also lets me dodge like, oh, and then when there's a join, I have to deal with aliasing because, yeah. And I can't actually really count on the ordering of select star being anything usable. So I just never generate select star.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm coming to is like select star in a view is probably an anti-pattern.
Or you don't generate that.
Could be an anti-pattern.
Users are just writing it.
Right. The users are writing it. And in my case, the user was me. And the reason why I wanted it to be select star was because I actually want this thing to be a subclass of the thing it's a view of. Right. So I want all of the I want all of the fields that are originally on, in this case, it's called outcomes. So I want all of the fields that are on outcome. And I want my class that I'm my active record model that I'm writing that's backed by this view to be a subclass of outcomes. It just has some additional aggregate data associated to it that does some.
So will the
statistics.
View then, because if you can't, if right, so if it's doing select star and won't let you drop a column because you're depending on it, and so that column's not referencing the where clause or anything, presumably, right? You're the only dependency is because you do select star. That seems like it kind of freezes the meaning of star there then. Like
yeah.
If you add a column, does the view actually automatically get that new column as well?
No, it appears that when you create a view in Postgres, if you have select star, it unfurls that star to the actual, because if you pull the schema back out, it doesn't have select star anymore. It has select all of the column names.
Ah.
So that takes me back to the original issue that maybe we can just use insertion order. And Postgres will tell us, like, because you'll have to insert them in the right order for Postgres to be pleased, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because Postgres would say, like, oh, no, you can't drop that view without dropping the one that depends on it first. And then you'd have to do them all in the right order.
That's true.
So, I mean, it's kind of like a couple different, I wouldn't say anti-patterns, but smells, right? So, like, views that are based on other views are kind of smelly, except you could make an argument that particularly for like materialized views, it's totally fine because a materialized view is a table. And then select star may be kind of a smell, even though there's good reasons to do it. If you don't have a good reason to do it, avoid it. Because, you know, particularly the reason why I wanted to do select star is I don't want to have the opposite problem, which is like we add a column to outcomes and it's not in my view until I refresh. But unfortunately, that is going to be the problem because as we talked about, Postgres just bakes in the actual schema for the view when you do select star.
Just monkey patch add column to go look and see if there's any view that accesses that table and was trying to do select star originally.
Right. This is when I start thinking about how to make this a good experience. I keep coming back to like, oh, I have to monkey patch this or I have to like hook into this. And everything that I'm doing is a monkey patch. Like we've talked before, there's no public API for what I'm doing. So I'm just, you know, there's some module prepend calls in there and things like that, which was alias method chain for a while.
I mean, I think a lot of it's just maybe add a like refresh view method that literally just ups the version or doesn't even up the version, but just runs the same creator update view.
That's already in that I can already pull from the schema.
Right. Just runs the latest version, not even pull from the schema, pull from your file. Right, because if you pull from the schema, it'll say select each individual column, but you want the original SQL file, which will still say select star.
Right.
But you could just run the latest version of that, and that should...
It's not always the latest version, though, right? Because you could have version 5 roll back to version 4 and still have version 5 on your file system and be totally fine and be running at version 4. So that's
Then you just need a metadata table.
Right. Or you just have, like, you could do that today just by writing, if I wrote update view version 5, update view searches, or in this case, outcomes. So I said update view outcomes version 5. It would know to look for version 5 on the file system and run that as the SQL for the view. So you could, it doesn't actually care what version is already there. You could just keep running update view. So we could basically alias update view as refresh view. You would just have to provide it the version.
But, which is, I mean, I think that's fine.
Let's take a quick moment to tell you about today's sponsor. It's Thinkful. Thinkful provides online design and development classes that are set apart from their competitors by their emphasis on one-on-one mentorship from experts. When you sign up for Thinkful, you'll be paired with an experienced engineer with whom you'll meet at least once per week and as you learn to build a website or application with HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and jQuery. Thinkful is a good fit for designers that want to bring their comps to life with code or beginners that want to be software engineers. They have courses for intermediate developers, too, that are looking to pick up new tools and frameworks such as Rails, Angular, and Node. For 20% off your enrollment at Thinkful, visit thinkful.com/bikeshed. That's thinkful.com/bikeshed. Our thanks to Thinkful for supporting the show. There's lots of reasons I keep coming back to that metadata table, and that's why the semantic versioning discussion brought that up in my mind, is like, it's a thing I think I want to do, and it's definitely a breaking change.
How?
Because I'm going to write the adapters such that they expect to have that table there, right? So if you have... Let me try and spell this out here. Let me think this through before I start talking. So right now, the way the schema dumping part works, because we don't have a metadata table, it goes to Postgres and says, give me all the views. And then it does create view statements in your DB schema file and then dumps the actual SQL pulled from the database for that view.
Well, don't you need to ask the adapter for all the views?
Yes.
So if the Postgres adapter expects the metadata table to be there, but that's internal to the Postgres adapter, that doesn't affect your other adapters. Like, they can choose to have a metadata table if they want one.
Right, but what I'm saying is it's breaking for people who already are using the Postgres adapter.
Again, but why? The Postgres adapter can just create the metadata table the first time it's run.
Right. So you're saying I could have this thing. Like, I feel like the blessed Rails plugin way to create a table is to have your gem have a generator that creates that migration, right? So I would have like Scenic install that creates the migration that creates that table for you.
Yeah, but then that'd be a breaking change. So that's not necessarily right. An option, unless you want to bump your right. major, in which case.
So you're saying what I might want to consider is when I run the code that says, "Hey Postgres, give me all the views," check to see if this schema information table exists, and if it doesn't, just go ahead and create it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, and like, just have a method where you get the data from the schema information table, and like, literally any time it doesn't exist, create it and populate it with the best guess.
The best guess part really scares me, because that could be a break. Like, that could break somebody's app with that. Like, I just feel like this early on, I might be able to just say, like, yep, we got some good knowledge out of more people using it because we declared it 1.0. And, you know, this keeping the metadata table was something I was always considering, but I never had like a very, like a smoking gun of like, this is why we need it, right? It solves this specific problem. And now I feel like maybe it's something we just need to bite the bullet on and say, like, you've got to run this migration. And then I got to think about what is the migration path to this? I have to think through that. Like, if you already have create view statements in your migrations, I think all it would be is like, you install version 2 of Scenic, you run Scenic install, which has a migrate, which creates a migration that creates this table. You run your migration, that table gets created, and then the schema dumper runs
and populates it with a best guess.
The schema dumper runs and populates it with a best guess. You're right. it would just populate it with like the most recent version of your view, and you could tell it otherwise.
And then just assume alphabetical order, which is what you've been doing already.
Right. That could work. Or insertion order, because I'll have to do some more tests on insertion order versus alphabetical order to see if insertion order might actually solve a good chunk of these problems.
whatever you do, though, right, once it gets run once, the problem's solved for you, because then schema.rb now contains the proper ordering, and so any subsequent runs of this would not be necessary. Well, would either run the migrations and then everything just gets populated properly, or it runs schema.rb, in which case, well, everything still gets populated properly because the create view statements will be run in the proper order.
Right. The scary part for me is if I bump the version to do this, right, I bump it to 2.0, somebody installs 2.0 but does not run the migration that's necessary for version 2.0 to work, and they deploy that, if they somehow get to a state where they are going to run a migration without having created that table first, it's going to blow up for them in production.
If you try to run a migration in production and not have it tried running it in development first.
But it could be two different developers, right? I'm just thinking through all these. See, this is why my mind just tries to think through all of the possibilities of breaking changes, and then I get really scared. Like with Clear, I'm scared to change anything because I'm like, I'm going to break somebody's app.
No, but see, that's the thing. It's just it's a question of cost to your users versus benefits to you.
Right. And I think in the Scenic case, not necessarily cost to my users versus benefits to me, but like cost to the users kind of in both cases, right? What's the cost to the user in keeping up with this breaking change versus the cost to the users I won't have that won't use this library because it has these problems, right?
Well, I mean, I think you could say you need to solve these problems, and then it's just like it will almost certainly be more code to magically create the metadata table and like magically populate it at exactly the right time. That will presumably be more code and be harder to maintain than if you just generated migration when they first started up.
Right.
But it's also good because you're thinking of through the migration path in all cases. Like,
yeah,
this is just how all people should be when they maintain libraries.
The good news is I have multiple libraries that use this. I have multiple applications that use this that I can test the migration path on. Because it's hard to think through, especially with the schema dumper and the command recorder and all that stuff. It's hard to think through exactly how everything's going to work. This shouldn't impact the command recorder anyway. Yeah, so that's basically, I have a few open issues that are sitting out on Scenic, and I'm kind of like in the mode where I just don't want to think about it because I'm not sure what I want to do yet. So I'm leaving them hanging for a little bit. Sorry, people who have opened issues. I'll get back to you maybe Friday.
I'm just saying, like, this is, I think, the appropriate weight to be giving making a breaking change.
All right. Good. I'm glad you agree.
I just wish more people would and not be like, this is just going to affect like 3 users and it's not actually that big of a deal.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm thinking, I'm just trying to think through the reasons to do the schema, like the reason to do the metadata table and the database is like, one of my biggest annoyances is when right now when you dump schema, it's totally like, it's hideous what gets dumped out of there because it dumps the SQL from Postgres to say like, I don't know what specific version, I don't know what file system version of this view this is, but I do know what the actual view schema is, and it's this. So here you go, right?
Right.
The problem with that is that it's hideous because I can't format the SQL nicely. So your schema file has all this nice spacing until you get down to the bottom where it has create view statements. It's just like a mess of disgusting looking strings.
Well, you could always just have a, I'm sure there's a SQL pretty printer.
That's true. I could look up for one of those.
Or once you have this metadata table, you just put out create view name, version from metadata.
Right. But then I was just thinking about that. So that's what I want because it solves that problem for me. But just thinking about that, going back to this whole Postgres bakes in what star means, right? So if I write a migration that has select star from posts in it and I dump the schema, so my schema is going to say that's post version 1, right? So my Scenic schema table says like he ran create view, the current version of he ran create view for posts, the current version of posts is version 1. Then in a next migration, I add a column to posts. That new column isn't on my view. But if I instantiate a new instance of my database, like create a new instance of my database and I run db schema load, or I run my migrations or whatever the case may be, all of a sudden now it has that column.
Right, and then you can write code that would pass on your machine, but other developers who don't drop and recreate their database, right?
Right. Other developers that don't drop and create their database, including your production environment.
Right.
So, soup, like, I don't know. Maybe there isn't a good way to do this except for like explicitly saying this is the, like, I don't know. What do you think?
The old warning in the README.
That's true.
I mean, if nothing else, right? Like, that's your 80-20 solution. Warning, don't write views that do select star. Bad things might happen.
Yeah. Man, before we started talking about this, I was like, I'll just put the metadata table in. And then, like, as the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm having trouble because I'm thinking of all the other things that could possibly go wrong.
Well, I think this is also partially Rails' fault. Like, it should just be fine. We shouldn't need to recommend, hey, do DB schema load, not DB migrate. If you were always just running all of your migrations, everything would be fine.
Hmm.
But Rails has created an environment where that's not necessarily recommended because migrations can change meaning. People do bad things like reference code from their migrations.
Right. Yeah. There's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah.
Anyway, if I haven't sold you on Scenic already, I don't know how I'm possibly going to sell you on it. It is interesting. Like, I've been, and it's partially because I am maintaining this library that creates views, but like, I've been finding more and more, like, anytime I'm writing a complicated active record query, I'm just like, okay, could this just be a view with a model? Probably. And there's places where I've solved a lot of like tricky N plus one queries by just being like, what if I created a view of this data? And then I can select from that view. And the database has to do all that querying anyway, but it's a lot faster at it than Active Record's going to be doing multiple round trips and then iterating over the loop to get some additional data for each one of those things. Like, when you start thinking about them from a SQL point of view, it's more interesting. What I found, though, is that like in the span of last five years or so where I've done more Rails programming with an ORM than I have written raw SQL, a lot of my SQL skills have deteriorated.
Yeah.
Because I used to be good at being like, oh, okay, well, then I'll just have a subquery here that does this, and I'll join to it from this, and blah, 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 we'll do this, and then we'll group by, and then this and that and the other thing. And now I get an error back from SQL that says, like, you can't select a column that doesn't appear in the group by, and I'm like, what do I do? What's like,
well, that's also a Postgres-only thing.
I don't think so. No,
no, it is. MySQL will just give you back nonsense.
Oh, well, then I think I'd prefer an error than nonsense.
I agree. No, but like literally, because it makes sense, right? If you do select users.something, post.name, group by users.something, like there are lots of names that I could choose to show you. So Postgres gives you an error like, hey, I don't actually know what to do here in MySQL. I don't know if it gives you the first one or if it just picks at random. My gut wants to say it gives you the first one because picking at random would be insane, but MySQL does lots of things that I would qualify as insane.
Absolutely.
One other thing, though, when I'm in these sorts of situations that I tend to do is I just push up a branch. And there's usually at least a handful of users, like power users, that I frequently communicate with. I'll be like, hey, guys. Or if it's somebody requesting this feature, you know, pull them in the loop. Hey, people who I know want this feature, like, can you try pulling down this branch and just poking it as much as you can and try and break it and see if this serves your needs, like any feedback on the API, or let me know how usage goes. And if they work in open source apps, that's even better, because then you can actually see like the code that they wrote to use the feature, but very few people do.
Right.
You can also feature gate things. I mean, it's a little harder to do. Well, it's hard to do in anything, because I don't know of any language that gives feature gating support for libraries. But like, you can always include it in a release, but require some explicit opt-in to be able to use it.
Yeah.
Explicitly exclude it from your public API.
Right. It is. Part of me is wishing like I discovered all these things before I said it was 1.0. But part of me also knows I would not have discovered them before I said they were 1.0, because there's a certain subset of users who just aren't going to use it in reality, right, until I'm ready to publicize it. And I'm not ready to publicize it until it's 1.0. This is a nasty circle.
But, I mean, right, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that as long as you're, like, the painful part is not wanting to make a painful breaking change for your users, because bumping it to 2.0 ultimately doesn't matter. Like, if the cost to your users is absurdly low, like, yeah, you're bumping your major and it doesn't matter. Right.
I think, like, for all practical purposes, if I decided to do this, if we decided to make a breaking change to accommodate this, whatever that would be, if it's that schema table or whatever, in all practical purposes, the migration process would be like, install the gem, run this migration, redump your schema, you're done. Doesn't seem too bad.
Yeah.
There are just corner cases that we've discussed that it could go awry on, and we'd have to like write some documentation on those, probably.
Beta.
Yeah, I mean,
0.0.beta1.
That's true. It's true. Have people run the beta. I don't have enough users for people to run the beta.
Well,
yeah, well, like you said, we do have a few people who are more engaged on issues, and we could probably reach out to them and be like, hey, try this. Tell me how it goes. Don't push any code with it. Just tell me how it goes.
But like as just an example, though, on the like major version not equal major pain, RSpec is thinking about possibly releasing RSpec 4 pretty soon. The only breaking changes in RSpec 4 would be the gem spec would change to no longer support Ruby 1.8.7 or Rails 3.0.
Right.
Neither of those actually mean that like you couldn't use it on 1.8.7. Well, you wouldn't be able to use it with Rails 3.0. I don't think Ruby Gems actually enforces the Ruby version. Maybe it does. But like there's nothing that would necessarily stop. They're not going to then all of a sudden go change all of their code to drop support for 1.8.7, but they'll basically be removing it from the build. But like, right, if you're using Ruby 1.8.7, which means you're using Rails pre-4, and if you're still using Rails 3.0, and you're using RSpec with those, well, then you're stuck on RSpec 3. But I really doubt that that actually affects terribly many people. I think the biggest people who will be affected are Bundler, who, if I recall, do use RSpec for their test suite. And Bundler does still support Ruby 1.8.7.
Right.
But Bundler's also been talking about maybe pretty soon dropping 1.8.7 support, so this might just be the thing that pushes them over the edge.
Yeah, we had an interesting conversation about that here with Prem, who maintains Appraisal, which is kind of like, I don't know how to say it, like a local Travis matrix kind of thing, right? Have you seen Appraisal?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's where you can run, you give it several gem files and you tell it which versions of Ruby you want to run those gem files against, and it runs the whole matrix for you, right, as part of your test suite. And a while ago, Prem went back and added support for 1.8.7 after it had been removed. I remember being like, this is crazy. Why are you doing this? And he made the point, which was a very good point, that like, this is a system tool. It's built in Ruby because it was convenient for me to build it in Ruby, but it should just run regardless of whatever version of Ruby. It doesn't actually have, like, why not let it run on 1.8.7? If 1.8.7 is the default Ruby installed on OS 10, then fine, let it run on 1.8.7.
On end-of-life versions of OS 10.
Sure, but like, why not? Or whatever Linux server you have, it had 1.8.7 on it, and you want to use Appraisal. Why shouldn't you be able to?
I mean, the same reasons that you shouldn't support IE6.
Except that the support cost of supporting 1.8.7 is a lot lower than supporting 1.8 supporting IE6 or whatever, you know.
It depends. Like, yeah, if the support cost is you use the hash rocket, then use the hash rocket, but. Right. Depending on what you're doing, the support cost is a lot higher than that. Right. And for 1.9 even, for Rails anyway, like there's a lot of stuff that gets cleaner and faster once we can drop 1.9 support, because we can rely on things like being able to take an unbound instance method off of one module and pass that into another module for a defined method.
What is the Rails 5 Ruby version that they're targeting? 2.2?
2.2.
Okay, cool.
A symbol GC is huge for us.
And required keyword args. That's the big thing that you get that with 2.1. But that's like when we did Scenic, we were like 2.0.
Well, we couldn't even rely on optional keyword args. Those are 2.0.
Right, that's true. When we did Scenic, we drew the line at 2.1 because we wanted to use required keyword arguments. But it is another, that's another thing we considered is like, what is our support story here? Like, I think the gem file says 4.1 plus, like Rails 4.1 plus, but we only test against 4.2. Because like writing a library as a plugin to Rails requires that to really test it, you have to have a Rails app to test it against. And switching, like having a shell of a Rails app that can run under Rails 4, Rails 4.1, Rails 4.2, Rails 5, like that's obviously coming. Like I'm going to have to test against Rails 4.2 and Rails 5. And you end up having to put like conditionals in your app, in your application.rb to let it run that way. And It's just not a great story.
What RSpec does is they run the Rails generator and then write their specific files, because generally speaking, the files that are relevant to what you're doing aren't actually going to conflict with like what Rails generates, because you're just creating new test files, basically.
Right. Yeah, we have a... Let me look this up right here.
They're also testing the Rails their generators as part of that too, which is part of why they do it that way, but...
Right, We do the same thing where we have a spec smoke batch file or bash file. Did I say batch file? Wow. I let your...
You've been talking to me about Windows too much.
I let your Windows talk. get there. But basically, does it generate a new Rails app? It doesn't look like it generates a new Rails app, but it sets up a Git commit like in the dummy Rails app directory and then reverts to that commit at the end. So it runs the generators, verifies that the files are out, runs the migrations, verifies that the views exist, like that type of thing. And that's all written as a bash script because Caleb found it easier that way.
So what you're saying is you have no idea if Scenic works on Windows.
That's right. I do have no idea. Patches welcome, Sean.
Well, let me get the Rails suite green first, and then we'll see.
Okay. It should be fine. I don't know. I access files. I probably throw some slashes in there, but I bet it handles that okay.
I got the Active Record suite green on Windows today.
All right.
Or at least for SQLite. I haven't determined if Postgres and MySQL are also green, but it's mostly just weird stuff. Like, we were keeping a file open, and Windows won't let you delete files that are opened by another program, but apparently Unix will. So we had a test failing because of that, and then a bunch that were failing because we set the TZ environment variable to America/New York and then do some stuff, assuming that we're in Eastern time. And while Windows does follow the POSIX stuff for the TZ variable and has the set TZ C function and the global variables that get set by that, instead of having a TZ or zone info file and doing lookups based on that, instead it always expects the TZ environment variable to be 3-letter time zone name for standard time, followed by the UTC offset, followed by the 3-letter time zone name for daylight time. So on Windows, instead of America, New York, it needs to be EST5EDT.
Right. So you just have a conditional in the code for that now?
Yeah. And RubyGems has a module method that checks if it's Windows, because Windows, you can check the Ruby platform and compare it that way, but Windows actually appears as one of four different things.
What do you mean, one of four different things?
It can either be MSWin, MSWin64, MingW, or 64 underscore MingW.
I want to know the story behind MingW. That's always baffled me when I see it.
It's just the minimal GNU implementation for Windows.
Oh, now I know the story behind it.
If Ruby shows up as MingW, it's because you used the one-click Ruby installer.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Oh, we should do that wrapping up thing.
Oh, yes, right.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/45.
If you enjoyed the show, please share it with your friends or leave us a review on iTunes.
If you have feedback about this episode or any others, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.